Welcome to the University of Washington's Political Economy Forum. We bring together diverse scholars, policymakers, and citizens to discuss current public policy issues, to inform the public about them, and to find evidence-based solutions. Feel free to visit our website at uwpoliticaleconomy.com. We publish new episodes of this podcast every week. If you have questions or suggestions for discussion topics, please contact us on Twitter at ForumUW or email us at uwpoliticaleconomy@gmail.com. We would love to hear from you.
Hello everyone, my name is Nicholas Wittstock, and in this episode I speak to Jacob Hacker, who is Stanley Reeser Professor of Political Science at Yale University. We discuss the new book, The American Political Economy, Politics, Markets, and Power, which is an edited volume by Jacob Hacker, Alexander Hertel Fernandez, Paul Pearson, and Kathleen Thielen. And here, a team of outstanding scholars is providing a new framework for analyzing and understanding the American political economy, a book that I can personally greatly recommend, and you'll get a glimpse of that book in this conversation. Hello, Professor Jacob Hacker.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, we're very happy to have you on. Professor, you are the co-editor of a very recent edited volume on the American political economy. So together with Alexander Hertel Fernandez, Paul Pearson, and Kathleen Thielen, you've brought together a group of scholars that has produced a piece of work that suggests a new avenue of inquiry and even seeks to establish a new field of study to study the distinctive features of the American political economy. How did this project come about?
So Paul Pearson and I have had this long-standing complaint about American politics research, and that's that there really isn't a field of political economy within the American politics area. And you know, there is stuff that people call political economy, but it really is mostly, you know, public choice and game theory. And, you know, there's a huge field of comparative political economy that sometimes takes up the United States. And but, you know, there isn't a lot of work that looks at the intersection of markets and governance in the United States, and specifically really focusing on some of the very distinctive elements of the American political economy. And so we feel like this is a huge, huge gap. And so a few years ago, we convinced the Hewlett Foundation that it was a real problem not to have a field of American political economy that was concerned with the things that political science is concerned about, like the distribution of power. And they provided us with a grant to do this volume, the one that you hold in your hands, and also to set up this network we're now calling the Consortium on American Political Economy, mainly because it's a reasonably good acronym, CAPE. This is a consortium right now of four universities, the four universities that Alex, Kathy, Paul, and I are at. But we hope to expand it to include a lot of top universities. We think that the study of political economy would be, American political economy would be a great way to integrate political science and economics in a more meaningful fashion, and also bringing in the insights of sociology. But most important, I think we feel like the biggest issues, or at least many of the biggest issues the United States is facing today are related to the intersection of capitalism and democracy. And it's a pretty fraught intersection right now, as everyone who is living in the United States and or studying American politics knows. But you know, the relationship between rising inequality and our political system, the relationship between a turbocharged capitalism with, you know, technological advances and huge companies that are increasingly concentrated in our democracy, and the relationship between our very decentralized and distinctive governing structure and what's happening on the ground and across the country, the growing split, say, between urban and rural areas, all those things strike us as absolutely at the heart of understanding what's going on in American politics today, but haven't been at the heart of the study of American politics.
So just to take a small step back, you were mentioning that you obviously have some connection here with the literature of comparative political economy that does, as you say, feature the American political economy or American system, typically referring to it as a liberal market economy, as it is typically understood as primarily relying on markets to coordinate action. Simultaneously, I mean, American politics is a subfield of political science in the US that studies a lot of the processes that you describe. But nevertheless, you assert that both of these schools of thought or to some extent miss important elements of what is going on. Why is that so?
Well, I think there are two reasons. One is, and it's mostly on the American politics side. I think I'll say more about the comparative political economy approach and some of the limitations of its application to the US. But really the problem is that American politics scholarship is increasingly behavioral and increasingly not that interested in the substance of economic governance. And so there's, you know, as an illustration, there's this big literature, and it's probably the most political economic literature in the field today, that's about the relationship between inequality and representation. You know, the work of Marty Gillens, for example. And, you know, it's very valuable stuff, but there's almost no attention to the kinds of processes and players that are at the heart of comparative political economy that we think are really important. So, you know, the comparative political economy framework basically argues that you need to think about economic governance as being a highly path-dependent process that develops over long periods of time, where there's organized contestation among very resourceful actors, that the policies and institutions that get adopted through these power struggles can be durably entrenched and have enormous consequences down the road for the opportunities, choices that citizens have and that policymakers have to deal with economic problems. And I think it's just manifestly the case that the American politics literature largely, but you know, neglects these key insights. The comparative political economy literature has generally treated the United States as a foil. You know, it's the, I wouldn't want to add a normative element to it, but it's pretty clear that, you know, the liberal market economies, they may have their virtues, but they're often seen as being highly retrograde when it comes to providing benefits or redistributing income. They have very high levels of inequality. And by the way, that's mostly true, but I think it's not a very complete description or understanding of the American case. And I think part of it is that the US is just really distinct from other liberal market economies or so-called liberal market economies. It's the UK and the US are just very different cases. The US has a highly decentralized federal system, closer to Canada's than to the UK's. But even compared with Canada, the US has a much less robust system of kind of intergovernmental revenue sharing or other policies that would sort of offset the highly decentralized qualities that we see in the American case. And so we're really struck by three features of US politics and policy when it comes to the governance of the economy. And each of them is unusual, and together I think they're pretty much unique. So one is this highly fragmented institutional structure where a lot of authority resides at highly localized levels. Two is a very distinctive constellation of and contestation among economic interests. It's both very fragmented, but also features enormous amount of class power on the weak labor, strong capital. And then finally, a really strong and enduring role for race in a way that I think is few counterparts in other rich democracies. And, you know, and I think all these are things where the US is both distinctive and offers some insight for understanding developments in other countries. So one of the key themes of the book is that the United States is really on the front lines of the transformation to a post-industrial knowledge economy based in cities. And we argue that understanding the kind of spatial, political, economic effects, the geospatial, political, economic effects of this transformation in the US helps us understand some of the changes that are taking place in other rich democracies. That's just one example of where I think we're hoping that by really focusing our lens on the US, not seeing it as a kind of foil or as lumped into this sort of broad category, but is seeing it as a really pretty singular case, one that is obviously hugely important in the world economy and in the world of business. Seeing it that way really helps us start to understand distinctive features or important features of other rich democracies too.
Yeah, absolutely. So these three key features of the American political economy, the way that you understand it, you just mentioned them being multi-venue governance or highly decentralized form of governance, sort of distinctive form of interest organization, and the systemic racial division.
Yes.
Or the special role of race in the United States. Could you elaborate a little bit further what the significance and impact of each of these key features is? So if we start at the idea of that the US being especially fragmented in its institutional landscape, what exactly do you mean by that? And why is that so important when trying to understand how the US both makes policy, but also what kind of power different actors have, but also then ultimately what the developmental effects are?
Yeah, so I think the best way to understand all three of these is to step back and just think about what is it that a comparative political economy framework on the American political economy would help us see. And we argue that it really helps us see what we call metapolitics. So by metapolitics, we mean something different from the kind of normal politics or sort of final decision-making that produces policies. We mean or that determines electoral outcomes. By metapolitics, we mean the kind of process of contestation over long periods of time that produces certain kinds of institutions with certain kinds of biases, certain large-scale policies that are embedded and difficult to change and that shape policy and politics going forward. And I think importantly, that also shape the kind of agenda of what's considered possible within these institutional and policy frameworks. And so we call this metapolitics. And one of the most important, and we distinguish it from, this is a turn of phrase that Kathy Thielen came up with, which I really like. We distinguish it from like last mile politics. So if you know, in supply chains, there's like the last mile. And we think a lot of political scientists are focused on last mile politics, like why did this law happen or who won, why did this person win an election? And we're really interested in all that stuff that precedes the last mile, the metapolitics. And so this ties into these three points these three areas that I mentioned earlier. So for example, the reason the multi-venue fragmented and decentralized character of the American system matters is that it just opens up. It both makes it very hard for any one center to govern. The federal government is actually relatively weak in many respects, but also opens up all these opportunities for groups, particularly organized economic interests, to venue shop. And so, you might think that's partly about venue shopping across decentralized institutions like states and localities, but it's also about venue shopping across the branches of government. So the courts, as Congress has become more stalemated, the courts have become this central way of dealing with fundamental economic conflicts, whether it's the role of unions or the role of money in politics. So this venue shopping and agenda setting behavior of organized interest plays out in this very fragmented and decentralized setting. And this makes it possible, I think, for there to be influence from a lot of different players, but it also puts a heavy premium on those organized actors. Those political actors who are highly organized, who have resources to move across multiple venues, and who are in it for the long term. And so, on one extreme, you could think of like the Chamber of Commerce or the Koch Brothers Network or what remains of American organized labor, right? They're organized, resourceful, they're in it for the long term. On the other extreme, you see American voters in many cases, right? So voters, may be very supportive of an expansion of Medicaid or the passage of a big social welfare and infrastructure piece legislation, Build Back Better. But whether that's going to happen is going to depend dramatically on not on, on voters, because they have very limited capacity to weigh in, but on these organized forces that are operating within this, this fragmented system. I mentioned that a key argument we make is that race is really fundamental in the United States, and that's obviously not a new point. But I think one of the things that this focus on metapolitics, right, on agenda setting, venue shopping, and institution shaping, right, this focus on metapolitics really allows us to see race in a much bigger way than the, at least scholars of American politics often see it, right? So we have lots of understanding of how race influences elections, or prejudice influences people's policy opinions. And that's super important. You can't you can't look at the presidency and election of Donald Trump and not think that racial resentment isn't something that's worth studying. But race has also just structured our political economy in deep, deep ways. And it goes back, of course, very long. But even if we look at the contemporary era, we're talking about essentially these durable inequalities for racial minorities, particularly African Americans, that have been baked into our political institutions, public policies, and into the structures of our economy in ways that that are very, very hard to undo, that create certain kinds of resource and distributional conflicts in society, and that can create very substantial divisions over, you know, what would be considered sort of class issues when they are surfaced in a way that, again, is hard to understand just in terms of the prejudice of individuals or the ways in which racial threat can activate certain kinds of voting or participatory responses. So when we think about race in this book, and we have a number of chapters that, that do a wonderful job looking at this, we really think about the ways in which the sort of structural, what's sometimes called, you know, structural racism or systemic racism, the way in which these structural inequalities are embedded in our political economy and really set very significant limits on certain kinds of policy moves and encourage in certain kinds of political coalitions and discourage others. And, you know, the most obvious case to think about here, right, is the ways in which, as the two parties have become divided over race, with a cleavage that everyone knows is defined by the Democrats' much more diverse electoral base, that this is actually really deeply related to the ways in which our political economy has evolved over the last generation, in particular to the growing divide between a declining, formerly industrial, non-urban America and urban and metro areas that are much more diverse and much more tied to the knowledge economy.
Yeah, speaking of the knowledge economy, the evolution of the American economy, I would say one reading of that would be to say, you know, part of the decentralization, or one effect of this enormous decentralization of American governance, is that it prevents regulatory capture, central regulatory capture, that would create something like a plutocracy. And that decentralization thereby promotes tremendous amounts of competition that also has a geographical spatial character in the United States to a certain extent, and therefore creates innovation pressures. And therefore, you know, the US is such a front runner in the digital economy or knowledge economy. But it seems that you're taking a very different stance here on that topic.
Well, I think what we're saying, and we have a wonderful chapter by David Soskis on this very topic, that what were once great advantages of the American system have become somewhat less advantageous over time. And I think part of this has to do with the fact that many of the sort of first movers have come to capture important parts of the digital and technology and high tech economy, right? You can't look at, you know, Facebook or Google or Amazon, all very different companies, but all first movers, or at least most powerful movers in key spaces in the high tech economy, without recognizing that that you can go from from a period, you can go from a period in which you have this sort of dynamism and innovation and growth to one in which you actually do see capture of markets. And I think the reason why this is hard to grasp is that it doesn't rest for the most part on the kind of regulatory capture that we often assume is the kind of bane of dynamic competitive economies. It revolves much more around the failure of the failure of effective regulation, period, right? So the degree to which market power is not countered by governing power, public power in certain key domains. And so, you know, there's this saying in Silicon Valley, you know, move fast and break things, or ask forgiveness, not permission. And that's a strategy that's open to American firms in a way that isn't true in all countries. And again, it has certain advantages. You can get innovations in new areas, but there is a point in which you actually need to stop people from breaking things, especially if they're breaking competitors. And you have to actually get people to ask permission rather than forgiveness, because what they're doing is increasingly undermining the kind of basic foundations of the political economy, including the basic foundations of our democracy. So I think the Saskia's piece on the knowledge economy, David Saskia's piece, argues that there's an imbalance that's been generated by, ironically, by the U.S.'s leadership, and that the key he suggests, right, is that you need to see more capacity on the part of particularly national policymakers. And, you know, I mean, I think we tend to forget that the digital and high-tech economy in the U.S., while it did rest on decentralized state and local action, it also rested on very big federal investments that were and smart regulatory policies that were enabled by a Congress and presidency that was able to act, right? And a judiciary that was subsidiary to those actors. Now, with gridlock in Congress, with the amount of economic power or political power that's often wielded by these organized interests, whose real goal in many cases is just to stop things from happening, it's much harder, I think, to have that kind of effective national framework. And so we're not offering a kind of normative case here, but I think if you're going to ask what's our distinctive take on the American political economy's conduciveness to the knowledge sectors, it's that that the U.S. has been extremely supportive. This political economic framework has been extremely supportive of the rise of the knowledge economy in the United States, but that now there are some real threats to the knowledge economy that are emerging. Because the system, sometimes that's because of features that were good during the knowledge economy's development and are now no longer good, but it's also because the system has changed a lot. The second threat, I should say, is the increasing rural bias of the political system. So
yes,
when the parties were not divided so cleanly between, you know, metro and non-metro America, we didn't see this kind of as strong an anti-metro kind of bias on the part of one party. And the Republican Party has become a non-metro party. And so the policy aims it's pursuing are often either hostile to or at least orthogonal to the development of a successful knowledge economy. And this isn't a good thing, quite obviously, for thriving, dynamic urban innovation hubs. But I think it's also a bad thing that these dynamic urban innovation hubs also lack a kind of effective party competition, right? So we've seen these areas become solidly Democratic or blue. And that also, I think, has led to problems. It's harder to address some of the challenges they face unless you can see both a stronger kind of competitive party system and stronger links between state, local, and national parties on the Democratic side. And so I'm speaking personally here, I'm extremely worried about the U.S.'s development as an urban knowledge economy, where we stood out from the rest of the world, if there continues to be this kind of strong push on the part of the Republican Party to try to shift democracy in ways that favor non-metro areas, whether it's through partisan gerrymandering or through restrictions on voting that hurt urban voters and non-white voters more. or whether it's through policies that are, you know, not supportive of the kind of investments in transportation infrastructure and R&D that are necessary for the knowledge economy. And at the same time, I think the Democratic Party does, under this framework, is also not, doesn't have the both the strong incentives and the capacity to address some of the really terrible problems that are afflicting some of the most innovative hubs, like the real crisis of affordability in housing. So I think what our framework does is call on us, or sort of cause us to sort of rethink the political economy, the knowledge economy, in a way that draws into sharp relief how the development of the American political economy has thrown up new challenges that our political institutions are at least at present having a hard time meeting.
That aspect really combines a lot of different elements of your framework in trying to understand the rightward shift of the Republican Party that is somehow intermingled with, on the one hand, the distinct, you know, political economy of space that is particularly salient with respect to the knowledge economy in the United States. But also somehow tied up there is again this factor of systemic racial division. Clearly, I mean, you mentioned this, right? It's hard to understand the 2016 electoral result and subsequent political convulsions without, you know, making reference to that factor. How are these things connected?
Well, I think the fundamental reason why we're seeing growing backlash against the knowledge economy, against the Democratic Party, and a backlash that's increasingly taken anti-democratic form, is that the United States, I think, has this highly unfavorable combination of massive inequality, in which you have a small slice of extremely rich people, we'll call them plutocrats, who are invested in, regardless of their party leanings, in a fairly conservative set and of national economic policies. And at the
Excuse
same
me, which time, is sorry, which is itself in some way institutionally determined in the United States context.
Absolutely, absolutely. And then you have a combination of that with a kind of massive and growing sort of populist, right-wing populist backlash. We call, you know, Paul Pearson and I in our work call the U.S. combination of extreme inequality and racial backlash plutocratic populism, because it brings together in this single party, the Republican Party, this strange combination of extremely conservative, pro-plutocrat economic policies that hurt many of the voters who vote for Republicans on the one hand, and these identity-oriented Republican voters who've been gradually radicalized by Republican elites and by the right-wing media. And it's a very strong political economy story. That I think helps us understand why the American system seems so fragile right now, because the very forces that have led to such high levels of inequality and have made deindustrialization in the United States much more dislocating, that have accelerated the kind of winner-take-all economy, both the winner-take-all economy of billionaires and consolidated corporations, and the winner-take-all economy of high-growth areas and declining vast declining regions, that same kind of dynamic has come together with this long history of racial conflict and backlash to produce something that really we have not seen in this form in this level of prominence in other rich democracies. And that, I think, reflects our political institutions. Obviously, if we were a system with proportional representation, we'd have a right-wing populist party and we'd have a libertarian party, right? We wouldn't have a Republican party. PR, you know, and the very strong pressures for two-partyism in the United States, which are really stronger than the lack of PR and the strong pressures for two-partyism in the United States, which are really stronger than anywhere else in the rich world. That means you've bundled together these, you know, this plutocracy and populism in this one highly reactionary party that is increasingly very skeptical of democracy because it's losing electoral and demographic ground. And then the other thing that's going on, I think, is that we are actually on the cutting edge of the knowledge economy. So the dislocations and the degree to which cities are economically vibrant, is coexisting with this harsh backlash driven by the radicalization of the Republican Party. And so that's, to me, the big kind of political economy paradox. And, you know, one way to think about it is, and this is something that I think grows out of the book, out of the volume, where we talk about the need for a new spatial political economy, one focused on the intersection of economic geography and political power, that what we're really seeing is a kind of paradox of density, where density matters more and more in the knowledge economy, and it produces great advances in wealth and innovation, but that density also is deeply disadvantaged by our political system, which has this very strong anti-metro bias, and that those who benefit from this anti-metro bias are doing everything they can to make the less densely parts of the country more powerful and the people who live within them. And so you have this, immovable object of an increasingly non-urban Republican Party and this irresistible force of urban growth in the knowledge economy. And those two things are coming into increasing conflict. And I see the fragility of American democracy, which I really, to the extent that I couldn't have believed 10 years ago that I'm worried about the future of American democracy, I see the fragility of American democracy as really linked to this sort of fundamental political economic conflict.
Right. Just to make that very clear to listeners, right? So the conflict being that, economically speaking, urban density is increasingly beneficial for knowledge economies. And we've spoken to Enrico Moretti on this program, speaking about the benefits of, and I mean, in your edited volume, Professor Soskic speaks about this, the economic benefits of agglomeration. But as you were just saying, right, at the same time, the specific institutional setting and political system of the United States punishes if you have specific constituencies that are packed in one specific geographic area because of the strong rural bias of different elements of the United States political institutions.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And Moretti's work is a real inspiration on this front. The extent to which density encourages innovation, encourages higher productivity, encourages investment in new companies, and allows for the kind of interchange of ideas and better worker firm matches. That all, I think, it's become only more true over time as the United States has moved deeper into this new world. But our political system has also cleaved over density. And that's meant that those institutions that disadvantage dense places, and those electoral procedures that disadvantage dense places, have become a lot more important, right? A lot more fateful. And I think it's easier for people to forget because there's a kind of taken for granted quality to American institutions among people who study the American system. It's easy to forget just how bias the American political system is against density. And we have the most malapportioned upper house in the rich world, and the Senate is the most powerful house, right? Things go to the Senate to either live or die, and often to die. So that there's the fact that we have the two senator per state rule, and the fact that that really advantages less populous and more likely to be Republican states. But then, as Jonathan Rodden has convincingly argued in his book, Why Cities Lose, there's also the fact that if you have your constituencies highly concentrated in cities, it's much easier in a single member district system to draw districts to clump those voters, to pack those voters together in the parlance. And so that has happened to a significant extent. The reason that Republicans have managed to gain power, even in this era in which they're losing demographic ground, in which the country is becoming more diverse and educated, and non-white and educated voters are more likely to vote for Democrats, the reason they've been able to hold and even increase their power is mostly related to the increasing aggressiveness with which they are packing Democratic voters into districts. You see that much more at the state level, actually, than at federal level. So it used to be that if you drew a map of the United States and you asked, you know, which states have a bias toward the Democrats or the Republicans, you'd have a few blue states and a few red states. Now it's just a sea of red. All the states that are Republican, are Republican controlled, have become increasingly Republican biased because the drawing of statehouse districts in favor of the Republican Party. And that's even states that are essentially toss-up states at the in the presidential races, like Wisconsin or Michigan. Those states are increasingly being reconstructed as Republican strongholds. And that matters because it is undermines our democracy, but it also matters because it means that there's a very different policy equilibrium in the United States when you have a rural-oriented party enjoying disproportionate power. And the work of one of my co-authors for this volume, or the co-editors for this volume, Alex Hurtle Fernandez, has shown the extent to which the more conservative business groups, the ones that really want to pursue kind of minimal government and tax cuts, they've really used the growing power of Republicans at the state level to rewrite the rules at the state level. And so, you know, it's that, to bring us full circle, the approach that we're arguing for is really taking us back to the fundamental precepts of political economy as political economy was conceived at its founding, namely that it's about understanding the distribution of power that emerges through the intersection of markets and government. And it really is understanding the foundations of democratic capitalism. We have a system that that is, you know, enormously important for determining who, you know, who has the capacity to live a fulfilling life. And that really isn't a product just of government or just of the market. It's a product of how they come together. And how they come together in the United States is pretty unusual, and therefore really needs to be understood if we're going to understand American democracy and the nature of the American economy.
Absolutely. In closing, in the final chapter of your book, you showcase how the framework that you present in this book allows you to understand how COVID-19, or rather how the U.S. both reacted to and was affected by COVID-19.
So I think our view is that COVID is like this shock to the American political mm-hmm. economy that really lays bare some of the fundamental structural features that are often easier to overlook when we don't right. have a pandemic that is tearing apart our society. And so the three examples that I think are, you know, that first of all, we're not trying to explain all aspects of the U.S. COVID response. We start with the point that the U.S., for a country that performed so admirably when it came to developing new technologies and most important, developing new treatments and a vaccine, that so it would showcase the power of the American knowledge economy. For a country that that had all these strengths, we've nonetheless seen very mixed, if not, I think it's fair to say, pretty dismal outcomes. That, you know, in at least three areas, right? We've seen death rates that are at the very top of the world, of the experience of countries, and not just rich countries, you know, with the exception of, you know, a few other countries, no other nation has experienced the death rates the United States has from COVID over the long term. And then the second area where we've seen a really distinctive outcomes is we saw a kind of dislocation in the initial pandemic that was deep, that was quite unusual among rich democracies, because so many people were essentially let go from their jobs instead of trying to pursue policies that kept people tied to their employers, even if they were no longer working. And that was deeply destabilizing. And then finally, we've just seen all the ways in which our both state and federal political institutions and policies are pretty weak for dealing with this kind of crisis, right? Whether it's the unemployment insurance systems crashing at the state level, or the fact that the federal government, even after Trump was gone from office, since he was definitely not a cooperative player, that the federal government has looked to have very weak capacity in many cases to deal with coordination of the response to COVID. So those three things are really structural features of the American system that were cast in sharp relief, or those three outcomes really cast in sharp relief structural features of the system. And so I mentioned the three that I mentioned, the weakness of the US and decentralization of the US governing institutions, that was very clear. The disorganized interest that we describe as another feature of the American system, that also was really in sharp relief. You know, the extent to which there was business lobbies were trying to push for immunity instead of trying to get a broader response. And then finally, the racial conflicts and cleavages, that in some ways, right, has become the most apparent effect. And, you know, there is a reason why, you know, George Floyd's death sparked nationwide protests. And it isn't just that this was another horrible case of police brutality. It was also because it was in a context in which people understood just how vast the inequalities were that were laid bare by COVID in terms of workplace exposure, in terms of stability of employment, in terms of having access to social supports, and in terms of whether communities could actually be safe because of how they were situated relative to the crisis. So to us, the way in which the American political economy experienced, if you will, COVID-19 was a really clear illustration of the core arguments that we were making in the volume about both what's distinctive and, you know, frankly, what's troubling about how markets and government come together in the U.S.
Jacob Hacker, thank you so much for being part of the UW PE Forum podcast.
Nicholas, it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to the Political Economy Forum podcast. Please feel free to listen to our other episodes on iTunes, SoundCloud, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. You might also like our special podcast on election security, Neither Free Nor Fair, which is hosted by Professor James Long and is also available on all major platforms.
Our podcasts are produced by Morgan Wack and myself, Nicholas Wittstock. Our theme music was created by Ted Long.
Please feel free to leave a review, as we're curious about your feedback. And if you have any questions, suggestions, or concerns, please contact UWPoliticalEconomy@gmail.com. We would love to hear from you.